Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Over time, we've seen an increasing number of clients come to us with symptoms of histamine intolerance, including seasonal allergies, headaches, skin issues, and digestive problems. And although doctors would likely treat these as separate conditions, we believe common root causes are certainly at play. We've learned that histamine problems often originate in the gut, but environmental and lifestyle factors can definitely make them worse. On this podcast, MBT Scientific Director and Coach Megan Hall and I discuss histamine intolerance, including causes, symptoms, and potential treatments. We talk about why this condition is difficult to diagnose and some of the signs that suggest your histamine bucket is overflowing. Megan describes the best options for fixing the problem at the source, including diet, supplements, and environmental changes. Be sure to see the show notes to get the outline Megan wrote to prepare for this podcast. It's an excellent resource for anyone who has seasonal allergies or suspects they may have histamine intolerance. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where Megan answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to all the replays, covering everything from receding gums to CBD. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Megan Hall. Well, Megan, how are you doing this morning? How's life in Colorado?
It's good. Happy New Year, Chris. How are you?
Yeah, happy New Year to you too. We're really good. Not much to report. We've been in the house for about a year now. Not much has happened apart from Julie got pregnant. Other than that, how are you doing? How's Cooper doing?
Good. He's behind me chewing a bully stick, one of his favorite things. Do you know what that is?
I do know what a bully stick is. I'm not sure that everybody knows what a bully stick is. I did encounter one of my neighbors recently, and they are of a vegetarian type persuasion, you know, they're yeah, these great chew toy things. I'm like, you know, it's a bull's penis, right? And they're like, no. Yes, a bully stick is a bull's penis.
It'll keep Cooper busy right now for maybe about 15 minutes. He goes through them quite quickly. When he was a puppy, he used to take like an hour to go through them.
Yeah, my dogs would demolish that in less than a minute for sure. Excellent. Well, so today we're going to talk about histamine, one of our favorite topics and one that I know too well. Unfortunately, that was one of my symptoms. I think I had all of them at some point, but definitely histamine intolerance. And that goes back from when I was a child. I'll tell you a funny story, right? So my mum took me to the doctor when I was probably about 6 or 7, I would guess. And it was a primary care doctor. And she described my hay fever and asked the doctor if there was anything that could be done for my hay fever. And the doctor recommended that I wore sunglasses. I'm not kidding. So my mum bought me these like teeny tiny sunglasses that I then wore to school the next day. And can you imagine how much people laughed? And I said, oh no, I've got this doctor's note to wear these sunglasses for my hay fever. And of course it didn't do anything for my hay fever, but it did make me look very silly at school the next day. Is sunglasses anywhere in the prescription? Maybe the doctor was right all along.
It's not. Maybe there is something that I don't know about. But it's not typically one of my go-to interventions.
And before we get into this, I wanted to say something about silver bullet thinking. I'm sure you've seen this a lot on client calls, as have I, Megan. You know, like people do the rounds and they talk about their thing, you know, the thing that's causing all the problems. And it could be histamine, it could be oxalates, it could be gluten. It could be MTHFR, it could be mold is another one of our favorites, right? Like, oh, it's kind of this silver bullet thinking. And I think, or you might call it overgeneralizing, you know, like thinking that this one thing is the cause of all of the problems. And in our experience working with clients, it's never just one thing. The notion of causality in a complex system is very suspicious. And you should think of it as interwoven causality. I like that term, you know, it's like making it obvious that there's more than one thing going on here. And I think that's part of the art and craft of what we do is like unpicking all these things and making tiny changes that compound to make big differences over time. And very rarely do you get someone turn up and like, oh, you're just eating too many mackerel. That's all it was. You know, like now I don't have allergies anymore. Problem solved. It was histamine. That was the bad guy. It never works like that. But having said that, you know, when you hear people talk about oxalates and MTHFR and all those other things I mentioned, there's a certain degree of truth to it, right? Like these things definitely can be problems. It's just that they're not the only problem.
I completely agree with that. Typically, it's not as simple as people think. But also, to say something else, things like MTHFR or more broadly methylation issues, if we're not talking about the genetic component, can be tied to histamine intolerance. So these things are interwoven. I really like that description as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually been one of the things I found has been one of the most important levers that I can pull is I seem to really suck at methylation. And my MCV tends to be high. And when I stop taking my multivitamin, allergies tend to come back a bit. And there's methylfolate in my multivitamin. But taking more of it doesn't help, right? Like taking mega doses of folate doesn't help me. But we'll get into that. Before we get any further, do you want to describe what histamine is and what it does?
Yeah, absolutely. So histamine is a biogenic amine that exerts its effects through different histamine receptors in the body, which are found in places like the heart, the vasculature, the lungs, the CNS, GI smooth muscle, immune cells, and also the adrenal medulla. And there's different histamine receptors in different locations, and they kind of induce different physiological responses. So there's histamine receptor 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And so is it fair to say that it's a chemical messenger?
Yes.
Okay.
Histamine intolerance can be thought of very basically as the imbalance of accumulated histamine in the body and then the capacity to degrade that histamine. And mast cells are largely responsible for releasing histamine along with other inflammatory mediators that can cause some of these symptoms of histamine intolerance if the body isn't able to clear them, break them down, things like that. And degranulation of mast cells typically occurs, and that's where the mast cells release these chemicals like histamine.
Okay. So explain to me what mast cells are. What do they normally do?
So mast cells secrete, in the face of things like infection, temperature changes like extreme heat, which could potentially go into like sunshine as you were talking about the doctor recommending the sunglasses, but extreme temperature, some people do get histamine-related symptoms when they exercise or mast cell activation-like symptoms. So infection, some temperature changes, injury when the body encounters like a toxic substance or allergy, some drugs can induce mast cells to release these things, and also inflammatory cytokines will be released by mast cells, and then they can also cause mast cells to release these basically mediators. They're mediators that work on different parts of the body through their different receptors. Histamine is one of them, and it causes a bunch of these symptoms, which we'll talk about.
Okay, yeah, describe the symptoms.
There are many of them. And some people may find that their symptoms are kind of centered in the gut. Some people may find that their symptoms are more centered in the skin. But the many different ways that histamine intolerance can manifest would include seasonal allergies, sneezing, sinus congestion, postnasal drip, loose stools or diarrhea, bloating, nausea, dizziness, headaches, flushing, so your skin getting kind of red and hot, runny nose, rashes and itching, hypotension, tachycardia, which is an increased heart rate, skin issues like hives or eczema, mood changes, irritability, anxiety, and also panic attacks in some more extreme cases, exacerbation of premenstrual syndrome, and also some food intolerances and allergies. There's a lot there. And like I said, some people may experience like a couple things from each group, but really histamine exerts its effects throughout the body.
I recognize all of those, apart from maybe the PMS, just mild PMS, I'd say. Honestly, seriously, all of those at some point in my life.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised, you know, just because of how wide-ranging those histamine receptors are in the body was probably histamine-related. And obviously, we're talking nutrition, we're talking gut health, but if there was anything in particular that really helped with your histamine.
I think the word interwoven is appropriate again, right? Interwoven causality.
Yep. As far as, you know, what causes histamine intolerance, what causes that imbalance between the increased availability of histamine in the body and the impaired histamine degradation, things like environmental toxins like molds can do it, or just general allergens in the air. alcohol and other dietary biogenic amines can actually weaken the protective barrier against histamine by competitively interacting with DAO, which is one of the enzymes that breaks down histamine called diamine oxidase. Nutrient deficiencies can also cause histamine intolerance because there are specific nutrients that are important to help those enzymes like DAO break down histamine. So there's B6, there's vitamin C, there's copper. Chris, you mentioned the methylation nutrients before, which are also important.
Right. And that's not for DAO. That's for the other enzyme that's used to break down histamine, right?
Yes. HNMT, I believe. And then the insufficient enzymes is a good lead in to break down the histamine. There's the DAO. The DAO and the HNMT scavenge histamine at different places in the body. So DAO scavenges extracellular histamine and is the main barrier keeping exogenous histamine from food from passing from the gut into the circulation or the blood. And then the HNMT inactivates histamine in the intracellular space. And this is the key enzyme for breaking down histamine in like the bronchial epithelium.
Right.
So two important enzymes there. Gut infections and intestinal permeability are two big things I see related to histamine intolerance. So DAO was largely found in the kidneys, in the thymus, and then in the small intestinal lining. And there's expression of DAO is typically highest in the small intestine and also the colon. And low levels of DAO, at least in the literature, are often associated with things like inflammatory gut condition, IBS, IBD, Crohn's, colitis, that kind of thing. And DAO has even been like posited to potentially be a marker of intestinal permeability and mucosal damage.
Yeah, if there is a silver bullet, I think this is it, right? You know, like this is the thing that really stands out for me as the most important thing to fix in order to resolve my allergies. Yeah, and it makes me wonder, what exactly is it? You know, I've read those review papers. Megan, again, has produced a beautiful outline that I'll link in the show notes. And you can see the review papers that we read whilst preparing for this podcast. I see all those associations with all this gut dysfunction. But what is it exactly that's leading to either an excess production of histamine or an inhibition of breaking it down and thus histamine intolerance? And it's kind of like, did you get all the way to like figuring out exactly what's going on? Again, it's an extremely complex system.
It is, absolutely. And I do believe that a large part of it, just because of that association we see with clinically with people and then in the literature as well, is that enzyme, the DAO, is made in the lining of the small intestine. And so if there is intestinal permeability, inflammation, especially in the small intestine, if we're seeing things like SIBO, or I guess I should say small intestinal dysbiosis, which people are more thinking it is now, if there's anything up there going on that's causing inflammation, intestinal permeability, damage to the mucosa, that enzyme isn't made. Therefore, the body has this imbalance of excess histamine, which it should be able to break down. But since there is the issue at the level of the gut, that enzyme isn't made. And the HNMT can't just step in and take over because the DAO and the HNMT are in different places.
I see. And I went back and I had a look at some of Lucy Mayling's writings, because Lucy Mayling's a microbiome expert that's been on the podcast several times before. And I know her quite well. And I know that histamine intolerance and allergies is certainly a part of her previous clinical picture. And she has indeed mentioned histamine intolerance on her website. We can link to that. And she cited a study, microbial patterns in patients with histamine intolerance. And she noted there was an expansion of proteobacteria and low butyrate producers. And Lucy's done a really good job of talking about that on a number of podcasts. And I'm sure it's relevant here, but again, probably not the silver bullet.
I would agree. And that would make sense when it comes to the butyrate nourishing the intestinal epithelial cells. And if they're damaged, if they're not healthy, then that DAO enzyme isn't necessarily produced. So
right.
That definitely makes sense in my mind.
Right.
I do want to say that there can be kind of this vicious cycle when we're talking about the gut, because gut inflammation and intestinal permeability, like we said, can impair that DAO enzyme expression and secretion. And then histamine intolerance may then manifest things like IBS, loose stools. So you kind of get this vicious cycle that goes on. Stress is another thing that can be related to histamine intolerance. IL-1, which is interleukin-1, that's an inflammatory cytokine, and also corticotropin-releasing factor, have both been shown to destabilize mast cells in the gut and release histamine, at least in a rat model. And then this kind of stress-histamine connection may explain things like why some people are predisposed to get or loose stools when they're stressed out. stress and activation of the central nervous system may also be part of the reason that histamine can be related to mood changes like anxiety and even panic attacks in some more extreme cases. Of course, there's also most certainly that gut and neurotransmitter connection involved as well. Histamine can regulate the release of neurotransmitters like acetylcholine, dopamine, serotonin, and also norepinephrine. So that could be part of the reason that we're seeing this kind of histamine connection with mood and neurological conditions. And then histamine can also induce bronchoconstriction in more severe scenarios, which is where that HNMT comes in, which can potentially lead to feelings of anxiety in some people due to perception of airway obstruction.
So am I right in thinking that if I can successfully manage stress, if I can cope better and become more resilient, then I may have less of these histamine intolerant symptoms?
I absolutely think so. Again, I don't think silver bullet thinking, I don't think that's going to change here as well. I don't think that stress is going to be the only answer, but I do absolutely believe that it's part of the picture.
So might I give a plug then for the group program that I'm running for the second time with Dr. Simon Marshall, where improving coping and resilience is really the goal. And Simon and his stress management techniques are really the best I've seen after 7 years of interviewing experts for the podcast. So maybe I'll link to the group program in the show notes for this episode.
Yes, you should. Estrogen excess is another interesting one to talk about when it comes to like the reasons that histamine intolerance can occur. So histamine is mainly produced by mast cells, of course, and then it's also produced in the epithelial cells of the uterus and the ovaries and also endothelial cells. So histamine intolerance may be especially prevalent in women with endometriosis or estrogen dominance, and many symptoms may occur kind of more cyclically during the menstrual cycle when estrogen is naturally higher. So during that mid to late follicular phase and also the mid luteal phase. And certain hormone or menstrual syndrome related symptoms would include migraines and headaches, diarrhea, bloating, mood changes, skin issues, which are very common in that PMS syndrome that we see.
So I read in one of the review papers, histamine, nitric oxide, vasodilation, vascular headaches. Does that sound right to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very possibly.
And I wonder, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm just at that stage of life with pregnancy and lactation and little kids. And obviously we talk a lot about ancestral health and mismatched diseases here on the MBT podcast. And I've been wondering, is being pregnant or lactating the default state for women aged 18 to 35, right? Like that's how it would have been for millions of years until recently when we have contraceptives and all this fancy new technology. And obviously a lot of great things have come of that, but is there a downside? That's what I'm wondering. Like, you know, how many women are having mismatched diseases because they're constantly having a period rather than being pregnant or lactating? I do wonder about that stuff. You know, I'm not sure I know what the answer is or what to do about it, but I think it's definitely something to note.
That's really interesting. Have you read anything on that, Chris? Is there any literature on that you know of?
So where I got it from is Daniel Lieberman's book, The Story of the Human Body. He certainly proposes it there. And then, so there's other things as well. Then they used to call breast cancer nun's disease, right? And they think the fluctuations in hormones is something to do with why nuns get more breast cancer, right? Like they're not having babies. There's a few things that are like, okay, could this be a mismatched disease that's being driven by the fact that women aren't having as many babies, right? You wait until the end of your fertile life history before you even start, and then you just about manage to squeak out one and that's it, you know? Like this is a huge difference over the course of millions of years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting hypothesis. I like that. The last thing to mention here would be genetic polymorphisms. Not a super big fan of focusing on the genetic side of things, but there are some polymorphisms in genes that encode for DAO and HNMT enzymes. That doesn't mean that you're doomed to a life of histamine intolerance if you have some of these polymorphisms, but they do exist. They are in the literature, and there are things you can do to support your body naturally breaking down histamine if you do have them.
Again, I think we're sort of fiddling in the margins here, right? Like you might 5 or 6% think like that's what most things seem to be worth in from the genetic standpoint. You do these genome-wide association says, oh, 5%, doesn't matter what they look at, it's 5% is the answer.
Yeah. Those are the things that can oftentimes cause histamine intolerance. I do want to talk about this analogy that I've talked about before during office hours with clients because I think it makes a lot of sense to people. So histamine isn't necessarily a black and white thing. I like to think of it as like a histamine bucket. there are definitely individual tolerances to dietary histamine, which we see referenced in the literature. We definitely see clinically. There are some people who can have a spinach salad with tomatoes and vinegar and avocado and two cans of sardines and sauerkraut, while other people can't touch leftovers that have been sitting in the fridge for 18 hours type thing. Like I said, studies have definitely shown individual differences in people who are given oral histamine. Not everyone actually manifests those symptoms. So these inter-individual variations in histamine intolerance are likely due to the differences in histamine breakdown capacity of the individual. As far as diagnosing or testing for histamine, unfortunately, histamine intolerance is difficult to get like a firm diagnosis on, and there's no clear testing. So traditional skin prick tests and blood food intolerance tests can't diagnose histamine intolerance. Sometimes these people with food intolerances and allergies do benefit from a lower histamine diet, though. Elimination diet or supplementation with something like exogenous DAO to see if symptoms get better can be really beneficial. And then typically after that, there is a histamine provocation, either with a large dietary load of histamine, or you can actually induce histamine load through an oral solution. That's what they use in the literature. And then you can test the DAO enzyme activity in plasma, which is a little bit controversial. And serum DAO levels do tend to correlate with histamine intolerant symptoms, like we mentioned before with those gut symptoms. You can also do an intestinal biopsy, but histamine elimination and reintroduction while closely monitoring symptoms should, in my mind, kind of be the gold standard for figuring out whether you have histamine issues.
And you don't recommend whole blood histamine is available or any other blood test? Is there anything you might see on a basic blood chemistry?
I know whole blood histamine is typically used as more of a marker of methylation status than anything else. I think I mentioned in the beginning, impaired methylation is often linked to histamine intolerance. And Chris, like you said, it's important for you to have those methyl factors in your body, just enough of them, but not too much of them for your symptoms. So you can say that if you have elevated whole blood histamine, there's histamine intolerance, but there is an association there, I think. And then looking at a basic blood chemistry might give you some clues. So for example, eosinophils may modulate hypersensitivity reactions by breaking down or inactivating mast cell mediators like histamine. And eosinophils, conversely, can also induce histamine release from mast cells. So there's eosinophils. Basophils themselves can actually also release histamine. And many of the symptoms that we see associated with elevated eosinophils and basophils are often seen in histamine intolerance. So while they're not specific markers, they're more nonspecific, they may have some utility when we pair them with symptoms and signs and tolerance to certain dietary foods.
That makes sense.
And then, of course, talking about the different nutrients needed to support DAO function, things like neutrophils may be a marker of nutritional deficiency like copper and could also give you kind of an indirect clue about what could be going on, but it's not specific in any way. Now, the question kind of becomes, well, what do we do if we have histamine or if we have allergies? I think that ultimately getting to the root cause of the issue is going to be the most important thing if you can find the root cause, and kind of tinkering and poking at multiple root causes. Like you were mentioning, Chris, there's typically not one thing that's going to be the thing. So fixing the gut, looking at the environment, supporting natural endogenous histamine breakdown would be important. If we're looking at supplements, which can be helpful, I think in the short term and even potentially more long term if people are really struggling, you can use some natural mast cell stabilizers and antihistamines. So those would include quercetin, luteolin, rutin, stinging nettle, bromelain, and also sulforaphane. And you can get supplements that have combinations of those things. You can get just a single high-dose quercetin supplement. And it's interesting because, for example, quercetin, you have to take quite a large dose for it to be a mast cell stabilizer. And if you have one of these supplements that is multi-ingredient, there's typically not nearly enough quercetin in there to potentially be effective. But what we don't know is the synergistic effect of all of these different natural mast cell stabilizers. So if something works for you, don't necessarily just throw it out because it doesn't have grams of quercetin in it. But that's something that I have noticed with some of those supplements.
Yeah, and I think the quercetin phytosome, you need less. I want to say that it's only 250 or even 500 milligrams for the, you know, Thorne makes this quercetin phytosome, but I think that might be a lot more efficient than just regular quercetin.
Yeah, that has been shown to be more bioavailable. Okay. And I would assume if it's more bioavailable in general, it's you would need a lesser amount for histamine intolerance.
I'll see if I can pull the data up on that and link it in the show notes.
You can also supplement with DAO, or that diamine oxidase enzyme. And there have been some studies showing that exogenous DAO supplementation does help. You want to take it, I believe it's like 15 to 30 minutes before you eat. So you don't want to actually take it with your food. You want to take it a little bit before. And then, of course, over-the-counter antihistamines are an option. I think that they should be very short-term and last resort. There's at least one over-the-counter antihistamine that actually has been shown to paradoxically decrease your DAO expression, which is exactly the last thing you want if you have histamine intolerance. And of course, those pharmaceutical medications don't necessarily come without other negative side effects. So they would be my last resort, but sometimes it's necessary to take something like Claritin or Benadryl short-term.
Right. None of those work for me. I don't know why. I really don't know. The only thing that worked was Pyriton, but it makes you super drowsy. So that wasn't really a solution either, but it did work. But none of the new meds, you know, like Zyrtec and all those, none of those. I mean, I'm not a pharmacologist. I don't really know anything about drugs, but none of them worked.
There's different H1 and H2 blockers. And then sometimes there's a little bit of evidence that suggests that if you combine an H1 and an H2 blocker together, it has a better effect than taking one alone. It's definitely not my area of expertise either. And then, of course, the other thing that can be very beneficial, and this is what I recommend a lot to people, at least short term, is some dietary restriction. So this would look like removing a handful of foods, which would include the histamine containing foods. There's histamine releasing foods. And then there's also foods that inhibit enzymes that break down histamine. And typically, I think you can get a pretty good idea about whether or not this is working within a week or so. Some people in the literature recommend going out to 8 weeks total, just to kind of clear your system and give it some time to heal. So there is no perfect food elimination list. We'll link to a good paper that nicely illustrates the fact that there is really no clear consensus on all of the foods that may cause histamine reactions. But there are some commonly problematic foods that I've seen, and those would include leftovers, and that's leftover protein like beef, chicken, fish, pork, that kind of thing, not necessarily leftover sweet potatoes. So leftover animal protein, bone broth that's been slow cooked for a long time, cured and preserved meats and cheeses, avocados, bananas, strawberries, spinach, chocolate, fermented foods, canned fish, smoked meats and fish, eggplant, tomatoes, citrus, any kind of slow cooked meat, wine and beer, some nuts, shellfish, coffee, and black tea. So there's some really great things in there, unfortunately.
I know, like the sardines, right? It's like canned fish, anything aged, fermented. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
Oh, yeah. It's one of those things where you may be able to have a can of sardines and an avocado, but you can't have that every day. You can't have it every meal. So again, think of it as a histamine bucket. It's not just black or white. You eat something with histamine and you get a reaction. Although some people do.
It's not a lifelong intervention, right? Like this is not the new fad diet of 2021 for sure.
No. And maybe some people are thinking, well, because I've just removed sardines and avocados and my coffee and bone broth, can I still have, and leftovers, can I still have a nutrient-dense diet while taking a low histamine approach? And I think you absolutely can. It just takes a little bit more time and effort, since you can't exactly just have leftover meat in the fridge, or you can't take out a can of salmon or sardines from the pantry. So a couple of things to maybe think about. You would need to cook and eat your meat and fish right away if you wanted to do like a very strict low histamine diet. You can freeze leftovers, or you could just make enough for one meal if you're willing to do a little bit more cooking. I would find a safe way to quickly defrost frozen meats. I would consider eating the egg yolk, but the egg white is where most of the histamine is, so you can still get the majority of the nutrition from the egg yolk in most cases. You can still have leftover carbohydrates like root vegetables, since they don't accumulate histamine. Again, it's that animal protein that really does, as far as leftovers go. And then most vegetables are going to be okay, other than those that I mentioned. So there's spinach, eggplant, and tomatoes are, I think, really the only vegetables that are very high in histamine. And unfortunately, most organ meats, canned oily fish, and shellfish are off the table if you're going to stick to strictly low histamine. They would definitely be some of the first foods that I would reintroduce when experimenting with how much histamine your bucket can handle. Like we said, low histamine is definitely not a lifelong prescription. You may only need it while getting to the root cause of the issue and decreasing the amount of the total amount of things in your histamine bucket. And you may find that maybe at some points in your life, you come back to a lower histamine approach. Maybe for women, that's during certain times of the cycle. And then something else that we mentioned before is addressing stress, which can be another helpful thing. And then removing and addressing environmental triggers. So that could look like if there is mold in your environment, because we do know that the toxins will activate mast cells to release histamine and other environmental toxins will as well. Then addressing those things, addressing any kind of environmental allergens, maybe getting an air purifier can help with some of those symptoms as well. Chris, what was, and again, I know you said it, you took a multifactorial approach, which is what we always do at MBT, but is there anything now that you've found that will reactivate some of those symptoms?
Yeah, for sure. So the low histamine diet, I did know about that in 2013, I want to say. And I noticed it was a sort of little lever that I could pull. If you lay off the sardines, don't eat sauerkraut, the cured meats especially, I noticed it was, like I said, a weak lever that I could pull. But it obviously wasn't the problem. You got to dig deeper than that. And even now I've noticed, yeah, what you said about leftovers, it's very unfortunate that leftovers are so very efficient. And perhaps that's one of the, what do you eat for breakfast? Well, whatever you had left over from dinner, right? Like, is a really good answer. Especially vegetables, for some reason, is my thing. If we have like a bunch of cauliflower that was left over for dinner, if I eat that for lunch the next day, it doesn't usually go well. Usually quite often causes diarrhea. So I tend to avoid that still. But I think, like you said, fixing the gut, we skimmed over that, but that's probably the hardest and most important thing. It's easy to say, but very complicated to do. Or maybe not. Like, if I just tell you what I did, I mean, so the first thing I did was a paleo type diet that people have been talking about since 2013. And it was Lauren Cordain's book that I followed first. But then things really started to pick up pace when I switched to the autoimmune protocol. And with that, I mean, everything improved, including my allergy. So that was the first thing I did to begin fixing my gut. And I'm not on AIP now, and I haven't been for many years. So I was able to reintroduce all the things. It's a temporary elimination diet. It's not supposed to be the diet for life. But then also, I think doing the gut testing and figuring out what's a pathogen, what you need to get rid of. And I've talked about that before on the podcast. I certainly had some protozoan infections and also a pinworm that were easily treatable. What do you think? What else do you see? What does that mean to you to say to fix the gut? What does that mean to you, Megan?
You can think of it as your very low level interventions, things like digestive enzymes and probiotics, and maybe some gut healing nutrients like you find in EnteraMend or GI Revive. And then there are more your, I would also maybe put the serum-derived bovine immunoglobulins in that category as well. And then from there, you have your herbal antimicrobials, which could either be more of an empirical protocol if you want to try it, some gentle herbal antimicrobials that way. Or of course, like you were mentioning, testing, seeing exactly what's going on in your gut. Now, there's no perfect gut test, but that can be helpful to take more of a targeted approach. So you can say, well, I have H. pylori with these virulence factors and all of these symptoms that are related to H. pylori. Therefore, I should do a specific targeted protocol to treat that. And then from there, you have antibiotics, which are my very, very last resort. I've only had a couple people opt to use them in the long term. Then there's questions of, well, is it yeast? Is it bacteria? Is it more upper intestine? Is it more lower intestine? And a lot of times these things are all connected. So it's someone might have a parasite, but they also may have small intestinal dysbiosis or bacterial overgrowth. So that's where sometimes the testing can be a little bit beneficial, is to go in and say, okay, let's really see what's going on here. See if we can pinpoint why you're having your symptoms. And some people want to start with those very low level interventions, which is often what I recommend, unless somebody is really, really, really suffering and they just want to test right then and there. Because sometimes something like hypochlorhydria, which is low levels of stomach acid, could be very much causing the majority of their symptoms. But we do see a lot of people who benefit from testing as well.
Yeah, you just reminded me. I did try all of those things before I got into even the elimination diets, the AIP. I tried all that. I tried a bunch of different probiotics. In particular, I tried VSL number 3, spent a small fortune on VSL number 3, and it came shipped in huge polystyrene boxes with ice packs and all of that. It didn't do anything at all, nor did digestive enzymes, nor did taking betaine HCL. I was taking fistfuls of that, didn't do anything at all. So I did try all that before moving on, but that's not to say that those things won't work for other people. It just didn't work for me at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, you mentioned AIP, you mentioned paleo. I think doing some level of elimination for most people is a really good idea. And that might mean a lot of people who come to us are already eating more of a paleo ancestral style diet, which is unfortunate in some ways because now we don't have that big lever to pull for people.
You don't even use the word. It's become so ubiquitous that people don't even use that word anymore. It's like, yeah, of course, you're eating meat and vegetables and a little bit of fruit. So everyone is.
Absolutely. Then from there, we can experiment with something like low histamine, with something like lower FODMAP. I rarely go down the oxalate rabbit hole if I don't have to, but lower histamine, lower FODMAP can be beneficial. Again, for a short period of time, and the goal is to make your diet as inclusive as possible over the course of time. But if there are things like other than the grains, the legumes, the things with some of those problematic compounds in them that can poke holes in your intestines, if there are other things that are causing you symptoms, it definitely makes sense to remove them for a period of time while you're also working on the gut, just to, one, relieve symptoms, and then also to lessen the inflammation so that your gut can heal faster, I think.
And you touched on something else I think that was important is we've worked with lots of clients whose allergies started after they took antibiotics, and certainly antibiotics were part of my clinical history. We were just talking about this, that, you know, when I was a kid, they had penicillin-based antibiotics that came in a milkshake, basically, a yellow banana-flavored milkshake. And I think there was, my wife Julie was saying that, oh yeah, we had a pink bubblegum-flavored one, right? So you'd had like a bottle of these antibiotics in the fridge that tasted like milkshake. Like, it's not surprising that the kids were chugging it, and maybe they didn't know the downsides of antibiotics quite as we do today. And so I'm not saying don't take antibiotics. I'm just saying just be careful with it. Like, don't leave a bottle of banana-flavored antibiotics in the refrigerator where your seven-year-old kid can find it.
I didn't know this existed. That sounds like a horrible idea.
Maybe they don't exist anymore. I should look that up. Like I said, I'm not a pharmacist. Don't know anything about pharmacology. But it definitely used to be a thing.
What else do we want to say about histamine, Chris? Anything in particular?
No, I think you've done a really good job of covering this. I think it's probably timely as well. Here in, I mean, that's another good question. It's like, is it like something in the environment? I mean, obviously, there's like something in plants in the environment that causes allergies. Like, I mean, I said that at the beginning with the hay fever. But it seems like different plants release different allergic compounds at different times of the year. Some people might be allergic to different things. And so the season is actually kind of different for them. Are you seeing that a lot with clients?
I have seen that before, definitely. Some people get more of the spring seasonal allergies. For some people, it's more late fall. It's location dependent as well. So I'll have different compounds in my air here in Colorado than you will in California, Chris. So yeah, there's a lot of different factors there.
Yeah, so I think for like tree pollen early in the season in Northern California is definitely a thing for people. Here in Bonnie Doon, we have a lot of these dreadful acacia trees, you know, like some invasive species that just release ludicrous amounts of pollen that cause people a lot of problems. And obviously, that can be an issue too. But in my experience, again, it's like, what are the things you can control versus the things you can't really control? And unless you want to move house. And I live in the woods here in Santa Cruz, and I'm surrounded by redwood trees right now. And I mean, there has to be loads of stuff coming out of these trees. But I can still breathe through my nose just fine. And that wasn't the case when I was back in England, and there were far fewer trees. But I just don't think that moving out of the woods is the answer. I do notice improvement, by the way. When I go to Colorado, for example, where there are fewer trees, or I remember recently we went to San Diego for the Ancestral Health Symposium, and my breathing was amazing. I was like, wow, I should move here. Like, it's because there's no trees, right? Like, there's just like a bunch of concrete. But then maybe you increase your exposure to other things like artificial light at night because there's tons of street lights and maybe the air pollution is worse. I just don't know that moving away from plants is something you should try and control.
I agree. And it kind of comes back to that histamine bucket.
Right.
That bucket's always going to have something in it from the environment, things that you can't necessarily control. So control the things that you can. Maybe you find that at a certain time of year, meals that are super high in histamine don't work well for you, but at other times of year, it's fine. And maybe it's gut related. So maybe you address that. Maybe you address the stress component. If there's a bunch of excess estrogen floating around in the system, if you're a woman, then maybe you need to kind of dig into the hormonal side of things and address that as well. So there's definitely a handful of things that you can control to lower your overall histamine load.
Right. And this should not be the war on histamine either, right? So histamine does a lot of really useful stuff.
Yes.
Exactly, including promoting the production of stomach acid, right? So you wouldn't want to eliminate histamine altogether. It's really about, you said, like managing your budget.
Absolutely.
Well, I think this is a great place to wrap up. Come and see the outline and review papers that Megan put together whilst preparing for this interview. And if you've done some of the things that we've been talking about and you're still struggling with histamine tolerance, come to the front page of our website at nourishbalancethrive.com. And there you'll find a button to book a free starter session. And during the session, either Megan or Clay will take a look at your history and share how we'd work with you. Don't worry, if you're not in the US, since we almost work remotely, we can work with people almost anywhere in the world. So to find the show notes for this episode, you can poke around inside of your podcast player, or you can come to the front page of our website, nourishplanetthrive.com. There you'll find the podcast link. It's /podcast. You'll find all the show notes there. Megan, thank you so much again for your time. You've done a really fantastic job in preparing for this. I always enjoy these episodes. Thank you so much.
Of course. My pleasure, Chris.